Yes. So page 13 is, we're just coming up to chapter 3 of the Torah.
Vahanachash,
yes. But let's begin a line or two before that, where we have the fulfillment of the creation of man and woman. There we have the man said, which is just the last couple of words on the previous page, by Yomer HaAdam, the man said, Zot hapam etzem atzamai, this time it is bone from my bone, uvasa mibsari, flesh from my flesh, lezot yikare isha. This one, in the feminine, shall be called woman. Ki me'ish lukacha zot. Because she was taken from man. Al kein, therefore, Ya'azov ish et aviv et imo. Therefore man leaves his father and his mother. V'davak b'ishto. And he cleaves to his wife. V'hayu levasa echad. And they become one flesh. Now, let's try to explore this. We did discuss it last time, but it's a topic with endless depths and subtleties. And we are really here talking about the fundamental purpose of existence, which is achieved by having Tzelem Elohim, the divine image, manifested in the world, and the divine image, God is infinite, God is beyond all form, but in terms of a structure which in some way represents not the form of God, but the inwardness of God. It is the union of these two mysterious beings, Ish and Isha, which translates as man and woman. Now, I did draw this on the board last time, but I think it's valuable for us to just consider it again, that we have these two words, so there we have Ish, man, Isha, woman. Right? The two letters in red are the same. What do they spell?
Ish.
Fire. Fire. Fire, which can be a beautiful warm fire or a dangerous roaring fire. And then we have a Yud and a He. And the Yud and the He are God's name. Yud and He and Vav and He. These are the two, these are the four letters of God's name. And Yud and He are the first two letters. So they are, in a sense, the higher dimension of the divine name. And the higher dimension of the divine name is there represented with the Yud and the He, as if the Yud were the seminal drop, which joins together with the He, which broadens it out, and then you have the Vav, and then the next He, of the divine name, which is described as the sons and the daughters. So the Yud is like the male, and then the Hey, the female, and then you have the Vav, the sons, sort of elongated from the Yud, and the daughters, another Hey, looking just like their mother. So there is the divine name as the combination of husband, wife, and children. This is a comment in the Zohar, incidentally, this idea of the divine name representing husband, wife, sons, and daughters.
Is there a connection then between the image that you've described and the burning bush?
That sounds lovely. Go on in what you're thinking of.
Well, I'm thinking of the Eish, which is the fire, and within that you've got God's name.
The divine, yes.
And that conjures up in my mind anyway, the image of the burning bush.
Very, very interesting, especially since part of the conversation at the burning bush between God and Moses was about the name of God, because Moses said to God, "What is your name?" And then God says to him that his name should not be pronounced. Zeshmi lo'olam. This is my name forever. And the sages say lo'olam is la'alem, to conceal. This is my name which has to be concealed. There's a wonderful hidden article there about the divine name in the burning bush and the divine name in husband and wife, in male and female. So it's, and it's a fire which is not consumed, so the fire keeps burning. That's this would make a nice you could give this as a, flesh it out and give it as a nice drasha in it's I'm sure that now you see the interesting thing is there is this, there are lots of discussions in the philosophic and the mystical tradition about what is the purpose of the creation of the world. Why should there be the whole project of creation? We've got the idea of God existing eternally. So God is eternal. What does he have to do? Why should he decide to create a world? Why should there be a world existence with all the associated problems that we see in the Bible, in the Torah, not to mention in the newspaper and in daily life? That's so there's a comment in a Hasidic text. He's explaining, therefore the world is has many problems and the wicked are very powerful in the world, as you can see if you look in a certain Kabbalistic book written in the 16th century on such and such a page. It tells you that the world is very difficult and the wicked have a lot of power. So for the author, he didn't have the benefit of the internet or television. So if you look in this Kabbalistic book, you'll see the problems that there are in the world. But given that there are problems in the world, or given that there is a world, why did God create the world? So one phrase that the Zohar uses is le'ishtamodan bei, that he should be known. It's some kind of revelation, a divine revelation, a revealing of godliness. And so it's a mysterious creation of a situation where God is hidden, and in that hiddenness we should recognize God, we should see God, we should find God. And that's an intriguing concept, because in order to say that one creation is there in order to know God, it means that there has to be something which doesn't know God, where God is not obvious. If it's within God, if everything is just the infinite divine, so the infinite divine is revealed to itself. So there has to be some kind of enfolding or concealment, so that the divine is hidden from itself and then it discovers itself. Now we are part of that process. It's something which is taking place within the infinite, that we are part of this concealment. And our own self-discovery and our discovery of the divine is part of that whole, is that purpose. And the famous story of the Baal Shem Tov, Rabbi Israel Baal Shem Tov, who encountered a little boy who was crying. And he said, "Why are you crying?" He said, "Well, we were playing hide and seek, my friends and me, and it was my turn to hide, and I hid, and they didn't come looking for me. They just went off to play." Right? So that's quite a miserable social situation. And the Baal Shem Tov said, "Ah, God says exactly the same thing. I'm hiding, but no one is looking for me." So, in other words, existence is a kind of hide and seek. Hide and seek, or self-revelation. Now, another way in which the Kabbalistic and Midrashic literature presents it is really saying the same thing, but in a different way. The purpose of creation is to make a divine dwelling in a lower world. That there should be a lower world, and lower here means spiritually lower. Spiritually lower in the sense that God is hidden, as we were saying before. And in this realm of hiddenness, the divine dwells. So there is a world of opacity to godliness. It's opaque to godliness. See, if it were transparent, then the spirituality in everything would shine through. And when the Kabbalists speak of different levels of world, as you know, they speak of, in general, four levels. Atzilut, which is the realm of emanation. Then lower, the world of creation. Then formation. And finally, action. Now, all these are really spiritual realms, which means they're translucent. The spirituality shines through. It might be more hidden, more veiled at a lower level, but it's still there. It's still obvious. But when we come to the physical world, which is the lowest level of the world of action, and there's suddenly a skin of concealment, there is some kind of veil, a thick veil of a different kind, so that we're able to look at something in the world and not see the godliness in it. At any higher level, it might be a lower level of spirituality or a higher level of spirituality, but the godliness is immediately apparent. Whereas at the level of our physical realm where we are living, a person can live quite a long time without noticing the spirituality and the holiness which is there in a leaf, in a stone, and even in a person. They can forget that there is spirituality in every person. And so this is a world of concealment. Now, in this world of concealment, and that's why it's called a lower world. In this lower world where godliness is hidden, the goal is to reveal godliness. And not only reveal, but that godliness should dwell. And how does it dwell? Well, a key aspect of the indwelling of godliness in the world is the union of Ish and Isha, the man and the woman, the husband and the wife, being together in a wholesome way, bringing about this revelation of the divine name in their physical life. And so there is a spiritual interaction, a spiritual interaction taking place, which reveals the divine here in an otherwise dark world. Now, obviously, there is, or not obviously, but I would like to make the point that even if you have one person alone on the desert island, there is a process of spiritual revelation which can take place. And so even though it's a man or a woman and they're all alone by themselves somewhere, nonetheless we actually have different qualities inside us, and we have within us 10 divine sefirot, the divine emanations, which express the divine name, the Yud and the He and the Vav and the He. So one person, just by himself or by herself, somewhere, can express godliness, and that itself is the purpose of existence. Because we look at existence as if each one of us, we're the focus. The Talmud says, Bishvili nivra ha'olam. For me, the world was created. So each one of us is able to say, for me, the world was created. And so everything revolves around you, and everything in the world is all for your sake. And it's a remarkable idea. And in fact, the Hasidic quip, as it were, Bishvili nivra ha'olam, for me the world was created. Now, as I often mention, and it's really a fundamentally important idea, that the word ha'olam ha'olam, the world or the universe, but it also makes the word he'elem, concealment. World is an expression of concealment of the divine, because without the world, beyond the world, is the oneness of the infinite radiance of God. So Bishvili nivra ha'olam, for my sake the world was created, for my sake is the whole concealment. The whole concealment and all the different problems that there are, and all the credit crunch and the war and this and that and the other, Gaza, it's all for my sake, in order that I should try to make a step in service of God in the right way, and all these challenges and negative things and problems are just in order for me to make the next move and for you to make the next move. So we are in a kind of a unique confrontation with everything, with God there presenting us with a kind of a chess game where we have to make the next move, and that's the ultimate purpose of everything in existence. So it's this focus on ourselves. And as the Rambam, Maimonides, who's often seen as a rationalist, but this is one of his intriguingly mystical statements. He says that a person should always consider that the entire world is equally balanced between good and bad, and he or she himself is equally balanced between good and bad, and therefore one's next action is going to tip the balance of oneself and the whole world. Now that's a very Kabbalistic concept, that one individual in the whole vastness of all the millions of people living in the world, one individual does something and that changes the balance for the whole world. That's a supremely Kabbalistic idea that's emanating from any one person is the transformation of the whole.
It's the probability of one, because someone's got to do it in the world, so that could be anybody. There's a probability out of the whole world that it's a one, that it's somebody. So it is
a well, it's, well, the way the way the Maimonides express it, it is each of us.
Yeah, but it has to be us as well. It has to be somebody, but it has to be. It could be anybody.
Well, but we have to pick up the baton. You know, it's.
We can't. We're not. We got a responsibility to do all the things that come into our.
We've got the responsibility for our peckle, as they say in English, our bundle.
But so I think where Nigel is going is, there is a story of the Lamed Hei Tzadikim, for instance, that supposedly are holding the world together.
Interesting.
Can you, I don't remember who said that, but it is a concept that.
See, there is the idea in the Talmud of 36 tzaddikim who support the world in some way. There is even a concept in the Talmud of 30 righteous Gentiles who support the world of the Gentile. So, and then we have the concept of one tzaddik who keeps the whole world going. Kol ha'olam nizan bishvil chanina bani. The whole world is fed for the sake of my son Chanina. This is Chanina, the son of Dosa. And Chanina, the son of Dosa, is happy with a handful of carobs and a glass of water. Yeah, a pitcher of water. So the whole world is fed with his merit, and yet he is happy with the simplest of victuals. The Baal Shem Tov said on that, Bishvil. The Shvil means a pathway. So this great person, Chanina, Rabbi Chanina, the son of Dosa, who was one of the Tanaim, living roughly the same time as Rabbi Akiva, he made a spiritual pathway for a channel of blessing to flow into the world. Now that's true, and the Kabbalists tend to emphasize the uniquely great individuals who achieve this for the whole world, whereas the Hasidic teachers tend to emphasize the power of every single
individual.
And that's what we see in Maimonides here, in the Rambam, that every single individual, in fact, it's interesting, he says, through a good action, one can tip the world to good, or God forbid, the opposite, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe added, or even a good thought. If it were just a good thought, that has a tremendous cosmic power. And so it's a way of saying that each one of us is really holding the entire world in our hands, and that it's up to us, that idea, that it's up to us, and the whole nature of existence is a product of our own, almost our own mood, that we can invest in the world something. We can discover gold, discover radiance, which is there. And when we see it, then it's there. Perception is reality. And our perception reveals an essential dimension of existence. Now, coming back to Ish and Isha, you see, man and woman are a kind of ideal form of this revelation. It's very intriguing and beautiful that when the Jewish people, as we continue through the story of the Torah, they build the sanctuary at the foot of Mount Sinai, they build a sanctuary, and eventually that sanctuary is transferred to the land of Israel, to Jerusalem, where the temple is built. And the key place in the sanctuary or temple was the Holy of Holies. There were different levels of holiness. There was an outer courtyard, then there was the realm, the Heichal, it's called in the Book of Kings, which is the outer holy, the outer sanctum, where there is the golden menorah, the golden candlestick with seven branches, a golden table with 12 loaves of bread, and a small golden altar on which incense was offered every day. And then there's a curtain, and there is the inner sanctum, the Holy of Holies. And inside the inner sanctum, in the first temple and in the sanctuary, which was built at Sinai and carried through the desert for 40 years, there was the golden ark, in which were the tablets of the covenant that Moses brought down from Mount Sinai. Incidentally, the rabbis tell us they were made of sapphire. So it's two blocks of sapphire engraved with the words of the Ten Commandments, which are seen as encapsulating the entire Torah, all the 613 commandments of the Torah. Now, on the cover of the ark was also made of gold, and emerging from the cover, what emerged from the cover? What was carved out of the
Kruvim?
The Kruvim, yes. What's that in English?
Like angels, no? Aren't they? Isn't
what are they called in English?
Cherubs.
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 Yes. The translators of the Bible couldn't find a word for Kruvim, so they just transliterated it.
To what?
Yes, Kerub.
Oh, Kerub. Cherub. Right, I see.
Yeah. A cherub is a kerub. So it's exactly, it's simply the Hebrew word transliterated. This happens a few times in the biblical translation. And what the Talmud says, and then Kabbalistic thought, is that these two cherubs are two anthropomorphic forms, one male and one female. And they are facing each other on top of the golden ark of the covenant. And there's a very interesting midrash which says that when God felt favor towards the Jewish people and was happy with the Jewish people, these two forms were embracing as if they were making love. Now, this is something spiritual. It relates to the inwardness of the divine, the idea that in the divine there are different spiritual aspects, of which one can call a certain aspect male, and the sphira malchut, the tenth sphira, kingship, is female. And there is a flow which is taking place, and a bonding which is taking place, that through the higher sphirot, kindness, severity, mercy, victory or determination, submission, dedication, there flows a flow of godliness to malchut, to kingship, which is like the divine presence. And that is the bonding together within godliness. And it is also manifest. Another image, incidentally, is that this represents the union of God and the paradoxical Jewish people. So God and the Jewish people bond like male and female. And so there too is this sense of unity. And then we have it also in husband and wife. So in husband and wife, there is an intense spirituality which expresses the dwelling of the divine in our physical world. Now this is an enormously powerful concept. But together with being enormously powerful, it's also enormously dangerous, like most forms of power, like nuclear power, fire, electricity. Anything which gives power also has a dangerous quality and can get out of hand in one way or the other. Now the Talmud says that when husband and wife merit together, then the divine name is revealed. And another passage in the Talmud would speak about a rabbi who used to dance in an absolutely crazy and ecstatic way at a wedding. It's interesting that today Jewish weddings can be extremely joyful, and it's a aspect of traditional Judaism that there are very, very joyful atmosphere in a wedding, even when there's a mechitza, a curtain which is dividing the men on one side, the women on the other, and nonetheless there's a tremendously joyful atmosphere. So the Talmud describes a rabbi, an eminent rabbi, who would juggle, he would juggle burning torches while he or if not burning, he would juggle things, sticks, branches, while he was dancing at a wedding. And he actually surprised the other rabbis, and they thought, this is going a bit too far. You know, you've got to, you're a leading rabbi in the community, you've got to behave with a bit of decorum. And they some of them were a bit critical of him. And yet, they eventually realized that he really was very great, and this action of his was very great. And the reason is explained in a mystical text by the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, that the reason why he danced with such enthusiasm, because at a marriage, something incredibly exalted is being revealed. And so the fact of this spiritual revelation of man and wife coming together, that yud and hey, that's something incredible. And that can only be, it's out of this world. And the only way he could express his joy at this revelation was through dancing, an ecstatic dancing. So it's something incredibly powerful. Now that's exactly the story that we are coming to.
Could I just ask something about the Ish and Isha?
Yes.
Physically the words are different, and you talked about their interaction, but in terms of spiritual potential, does the Ish have a greater capacity than the Isha, or are they identical, or are they different in a sense, but in terms of merit one doesn't distinguish between them?
No, I would say that each of them have something very powerful which is distinct in certain ways from the other, but also each person is distinct and unique. If you took two men or two women or 10 women, each person has a different quality, something special, something unique. There's a way of describing the individuals in the Jewish people as the letters of a Torah scroll. In other words, each one is absolutely fundamental, because whichever letter it is, if you took away that letter, then the Torah scroll would not be able to function. It wouldn't be a kosher Torah scroll. So each one is giving something unique and valuable. And in order to discover the full potential of every man and woman, they go through education and different stages of life, in which each one of them is experiencing and discovering and revealing their spiritual qualities. And the spiritual qualities within any individual are infinite. And so each one is important, each one is fundamental. And when they come together, that coming together is something crucial for each of them and for the existence of everything around them. So it's a way of looking at existence where every single point is infinitely significant. Now, in my academic work, trying to discuss sort of conceptual models for this, you see, you have the idea of a hierarchy. So a hierarchy is that at the top is, you know, the king. And then, like in the feudal system, that was a hierarchy. You have the king at the top, then you have the lords, and then you have the knights, and then you have the serfs. And in everyone's understanding, the king was very important, and the serfs were unimportant. So that's the feudal system, and it was a kind of a static system. You couldn't very easily change from being a serf to becoming a king, or even becoming a knight. It was a static structure. Of course, they had Jews in the medieval world, and the Jews were a factor which broke through some of the edges over here and helped create a middle class, a merchant class, and so all kinds of things took place. Some of it blamed on the Jews, or justly or not. And you come to the modern period where you actually still have a kind of a center and a periphery. There is really still a kind of hierarchy. The only thing is, the periphery, the people on the edge, have more influence over who is at the center. So we can vote. So it's not just a king who is there because his father was the king. It's we can vote, and we can start a whole campaign, and someone can make and write articles and produce TV plays and films and news broadcasts in order to push the system that we want to push, and we can get our man into power, or indeed perhaps one of us will become president. Every American boy or girl can become president. That's the idea. But there's still center and periphery. There's only the question that in the modern period, so the periphery has more influence over the center. The Jewish model is a little bit different. Yes, you have great rabbis and teachers and so on, but fundamentally, each person is the center. Each individual is crucially important for the whole. And that is what, if we go back to sort
that's
of...
That's why they argue so much.
That's a good point. That's like Golda Meir's comment to the American president. I think it's apocryphal, but he said, here you are in a country with 500 million people, and your little country has only got, at that point it had like 3 million people, 2 million people. She said, yeah, but in my country there are 2 million presidents. So, and that's the postmodern way of looking at things, that each person is the center, and you can't say that anyone is higher than them, because every single person is significant and has an effect on the totality. So when you're speaking about Ish and Isha, certainly each one is infinitely valuable. And how do you can't compare infinities. It's interesting, there is a mathematical science of infinities. There was a mathematician, a Jewish mathematician actually, who began speaking about different orders of infinity, and he called infinity by the letter Aleph. He used the letter Aleph to represent infinity, and so there's Aleph with a little naught at the bottom, which is the first order, then there's Aleph with a little one, Aleph with a little two, and it goes up and up and up and up till you get Aleph with a little Aleph at the bottom. In an infinite order of infinity. But nonetheless, every single person has got infinity within them in an extraordinary degree, and when we, whether alone or coming together, there is this enormous energy. Now the energy which is there between a husband and wife, between a man and a woman, is expressed in their physical being as well as in their psychological relationship. The love between a husband and wife is something which can be one's spouse, can be the other side of the world. And you stretch out your arms and you feel, yes, there's the world in between us, and nonetheless we are together. And there is that sense, there can be, hopefully there is, that sense of eternal, powerful bond. But at the same time, ultimately, it's expressed through physical union of two physical bodies. Now there we come to the line which introduces the next part of the story. Vayiyu shneim arumin, and they were both naked. Ha'adam v'ishto, the man, Adam, and his wife. V'lo yitboshash, and they were not ashamed. Here is something so intriguing, that God created us as human beings, and that sense of the physicality of the person, which is the vehicle to reveal this tremendous spiritual radiance between and within husband and wife, and nonetheless it could be a cause for shame. And at this point it wasn't a cause for shame, because there was only holiness. Everything was completely, it was physical, but at the same time the divine was dwelling in the physicality, and the holiness was revealed. And so therefore there was nothing shameful. For them to make love was a mitzvah, was a beautiful expression of something divine, like a person lights a beautiful candle for Shabbat or something like that. It was a spiritual action. It was purely that, without any other veiling or ambiguities. It was just something totally pure. And now we come to the nachash, to the serpent. V'hanachash haya arum mikol chayat hasadeh. And the snake was more cunning than all the other beasts of the field. Asher asa Hashem Elokim, which God had created. And now the nachash, the snake, the serpent, is going to get into a conversation with a woman, as we're going to see, and as is so famous. What was the problem of the nachash? What was it that the serpent wanted? What did it desire?
And why did God create him?
Ah, yes, why did God create? Yes.
If it was also beautiful and perfect.
Yes. So here we come to the mystery of darkness, of evil, of concealment, of temptation.
Yes, why is it then? That's interesting. Why is it that a snake is always seen as bad, slippery, you know, trouble? Not the other way. It's interesting, isn't it? Does it come from...
I think there are cultures where the snake is an emblem of something good. So it's not. I don't think it's uniquely bad. There are people for, I mean, snake charmers who exist in India and are mentioned in the Talmud. As for them, I think, and also certainly for naturalists in the London Zoo. for whom snakes are very friendly creatures.
Natural scientists, medicine.
Yes.
There are different potions and medicine from snakes.
So, but it is. What do you say?
And nice shoes.
And nice shoes. But, I mean, the face of the snake can look very, very sinister. And the forked tongue, and the fact of many snakes being poisonous, and just the physical form. And there is something somewhat archetypal about this dangerous quality. And... I would imagine that psychoanalysts would give a phallic image to the snake as the negative phallus. That's the positive phallus in the sense of the beautiful union between husband and wife. And there's also the negative, rape or other forms of relationship in which what can be so holy and beautiful is taken in the wrong way and becomes debasing and negative. In fact, the sages tell us in the Midrash that the snake saw Adam and Eve making love, and the snake desired Eve. And that's really what it is trying to do. And so from the point of view of this midrashic cycle, the apparent story is veiling another story where the snake had intercourse with Eve and impregnated her. And that is the shamefulness, and that is the negativity.
Oh, gosh.
So that is the...
So that's the dark side of humanity, basically.
Yes.
I mean, if we look at the metaphor, that's
yes.
What,
yes.
Wow, that's very powerful.
Yeah. Yes. So there is this zuhama, it's called the zuhama, and the filth of the serpent became a part of physicality, so that physicality is something shameful. We are ashamed of our naked body, unless in very special, intimate, and unique situations. But otherwise, the naked body has something shameful about it. And that shameful about it is the extra measure of concealment that was imparted to physicality through the fact of this interaction with the snake, which somehow then involves both Eve and Adam, and disobeying God, doing something which in some way is disobeying the divine. And there was, in fact, one of the sages puts it that when they discovered that they were naked, what does it mean they were naked? They had one mitzvah, one command from the divine, not to eat from the tree of knowledge, and they've broken that command, and so therefore at this point they're naked. So they've become, they had a garment, a spiritual garment, and they've lost that garment by breaking that rule. So the question of why evil is there in a sense, has been very much part of these discussions that we've had. Because at the very beginning, we talked about the breaking of the vessels, a kind of spiritual climactic event, which preceded the physical creation of existence. But it's a force which, or an explosion of energy, of spiritual energy, that there is a divine radiance which could not be contained. It was so intense, it could not be contained, and therefore it led to the concealment of holiness and in the forces which are negative forces. And those negative forces, at a certain level, they rest, they are within us, and we have our own hierarchy of negative forces to contend with.
And this is what we have to work through life.
Yes. Yes, and there is a continuous challenge of different negative forces. And there's a beautiful passage somewhere which describes, it sort of gives a list of what are the different kinds of difficult desires that people have to contend with from childhood and then youth and then later on and then as they get older and then old age. And in old age, there's the desire for honor.
I read that somewhere.
So there is, it's a continuous chain of different issues that bother a person and which they can't control and they are struggling with. Or they hopefully maybe they can control. But there's always some kind of problem. So now let's see what actually happens in the text. So, Vayome el Haisha, the snake said to the woman, Afki ama Elokim, did God really say, Lo tochlu mikol eitz hagan, that you shouldn't eat from any of the trees of the garden? And the woman said to the snake, we can eat from the trees of the garden. It's only the one tree in the middle of the garden. God said, you shouldn't eat it, and you shouldn't touch it, pen tamutun, in case you die. It's interesting, the getting into the conversation
of death.
It's
also the first time that death is mentioned.
Yes, because at this stage, death is not really in the picture.
In the picture, yeah.
That's right, because what the nachash, what the snake brings, is death as well. However, it's a kind of vignette of seduction. How do you get into conversation with someone when you want to get something from them? And this discussion that the snake introduces, which is, he broadens the whole thing. Oh, you can't eat anything. Oh yeah, we can eat. It's only that one tree we can't eat. And then she goes a step further. She says, not only can't we eat from it, God said we shouldn't touch it. Now the commentators point out that she added a command that God hadn't said. God didn't say, don't touch it. God said, don't eat from it. And then the snake, which is not written in the text, the snake pushed her hand and she touched the tree. And nothing happened. She didn't die. The world didn't blow up. The sky didn't go red with fire. She touched the tree, nothing happened. So it's all right. There's no problem.
what's your source for saying that this text is missing, that the serpent encouraged her to touch
it?
And how does that square then with you know, the revelation at Sinai? This is the text.
Well, you see, the traditional text, you have here the biblical text, and then you have Rush's commentary and Ramban's commentary, and there's a whole mass of further teaching, you know. Sometimes it's just a few lines and there's a whole lot of commentary, and these commentaries come partly from the Midrash and from the Talmud, which is the oral Torah which accompanies the written Torah. And so very often the oral Torah illuminates some aspect of the written Torah by putting in a little bit extra in the story, sometimes quite surprising. And in that way one is able to understand deeper dimensions of what is actually taking place, or extra dimensions. So it's not just one story. The story has many different qualities to it. And so the fact that we are given the written text, which is the written Torah, and then there's the oral Torah in all its different dimensions, and there is the idea that there are four different levels of every teaching in the Torah. The pshat, the simple level, the remez, the hint, the drush, which is a further dimension, and the soid, which is the secret. So it's pshat, remez, drush, soid, which makes the word pardes, paradise. And that's the orchard, and pardes means actually an orchard, so it's the orchard of Torah, and to be able to stroll in the orchard of Torah, that's where these spiritual encounters take place. And then there's another idea that within each word there could be 70 different explanations, like a hammer smiting the rock and sparks fly off in all directions.
Isn't it from the Zohar, that statement, that there are 70 explanations to every word in the Torah?
It's actually in the Talmud.
Kafatish
Yufotzet Sela.
70.
Yeah. Whether the number 70 is there, but the idea of the hammer on the rock, that's certainly a Talmudic concept.
No, I'm talking about the 70, because I've heard it before.
It might be, I'm not sure. But what is this idea of the multiplicity of the text is a way in which we can understand the text of having meaning for each person. It's as if each person has their own reading of the Torah, and the Torah is coming to speak to them in their unique individual way, giving them the kind of guidance they need. And that's part of the whole process of teaching Torah, the great sages who teach Torah in the different generations, giving their generation the dimension of Torah which it needs to face the challenges of that time, or of this individual to face his challenges or her challenges. And so the Torah is a well, it's a tremendous well from which we can gain more and more. Vayomer hanachash, so here we are, verse 4. Vayomer hanachash el isha, the snake said, the serpent said to the woman, lo mot tumutum, you won't die. Ki yodeh likim, because God knows, ki biyoma cholchem mimenu, that when you, on the day that you eat from this tree, v'nifkachu einechem, your eyes will be opened, v'yitem kelokim, and you will be like God, yodeh tov v'ra, knowing good and evil. Now, knowing good and evil is a very interesting idea, as opposed to innocence, not knowing good and evil. And I think this is quite a universal concept, the idea of the innocence of a child, for example. The quality of innocence, with the special beauty that that innocence has. And then the idea of knowing, of having knowledge. Now the problem is that knowledge is not just abstract knowledge. Knowledge is a form of bonding with the thing that we know. So when we read something, there is a kind of interaction, and it's telling us about some maybe horrible event. There is a sense in which we are bonding and connecting with that piece of knowledge, that piece of information. And there is an interesting comment here in this text, which is actually written in English, which I thought might be useful for us. So this is from a Kabbalistic Hasidic teaching about 150 or nearly 200 years old. Three points require clarification. A. Why did God not want man to, quote, be like God, knowing good and evil? Surely God is unboundingly benevolent. God is good. He would want his creation to share some of his exalted wisdom. After all, man was created in the image of God. That's one question. Why didn't God want man to be like God, knowing good and evil? B. Then it goes on, even if man sinned, why could he not eat from the tree of life and live forever? Because this is what it says further on, that God has to drive man, Adam and Eve, out of the Garden of Eden, because if not, he will stretch out his hand and take also from the tree of life and eat from it, and he'll be able to live forever. So what's wrong with that? Why shouldn't that be a good thing? If sin, the sin of eating from the tree of knowledge, brought death into the world, if Adam eats from the tree of life and will live forever, so he'll be cancelling out the effect of the sin. Right. Now, as we'll be reading, Adam and Eve were then expelled from the Garden of Eden, and Adam had to work the land which was cursed. The fact that the man was expelled from the Garden of Eden is understood. He'd abused his right to remain there by eating from the tree. But why was he then told to cultivate the earth? What's the reason for that? Okay. So those three questions are then answered. Let's try and understand the answer. God did not want man to become aware of the concept of evil because man is unable to remain totally aloof from things that he comes to understand. Man's nature is to inquire, to empathize, to interact. When he encounters a new phenomenon, he wonders how it might affect his life. He begins to measure the idea according to the established norms of his conscious existence, and he allows his emotions to explore the new entity to see if he has discovered a new love or a new hate. In short, when a person encounters something utterly new, he investigates it with the totality of his personality. From that point on, the concept leaves an indelible mark on his life. So God was aware that if man was to come to, quote, know evil, the results would be disastrous. For in the process of his exploratory investigations, man would inevitably become attached to it. Interesting. So what it's saying is that we cannot have a completely objective view. We get sucked into it. It's like reading something pornographic. The person is drawn into the picture. He or she is not able to be completely separate. Thus, when man sinned and became attached to evil, two major problems arose. First, if he were now to live forever, he would cause evil to be perpetuated eternally. For since he'd now incorporated evil into his system, eternal life would provide a kind of eternal host for man's newly found parasite, negativity, evil. Therefore, God decreed that man must die and prevented him from eating from the tree of life, which would have returned him to his previous immortal status. But now he's got the parasite of evil in him. That would be a problem. If he lives forever now, it's going to be a problem. Without first getting rid of that drop of evil that he's imbibed. A further more serious problem was how to correct the event which had occurred. The boundaries between good and evil had become blurred, and man found himself attracted to two mutually exclusive forces. His sin had generated cosmic repercussions in the upper realms, causing good and evil to coalesce, to merge together, resulting in a corrupted spirituality which had penetrated the entire universe right down to the physical world. In other words, the action of eating from the tree of knowledge caused a confusion of dimensions which in themselves have a purpose. Now, one of the images that's used for this is the nut and the shell of the nut. A shell of a nut has a purpose. It protects the nut. If you break the shell, and imagine you do it very carelessly, and you crunch it with a nutcracker, which has now broken the shell, and it's also broken the nut, and it's all in bits. Mm. And now you can't tell which bit is shell and which bit is nut. That's like the confusion that was caused in existence. There were boundaries which were keeping everything healthily in the right place. Now those boundaries have been blurred. And as a result, God sent him out of the Garden of Eden to cultivate the earth from which he'd been taken. Man had mixed good and evil throughout the spiritual and physical worlds. Incredible what power Adam and Eve had, incidentally. So he was sent out to correct the damage that he had caused. Since evil had penetrated the actual earth, man was given the task of refining the entire world. By performing the appropriate action with each piece of physicality, he would set free the kernel of good within it, the nut, and now allowing it to return to its holy source. To correct the world which he had profaned, man was required to pick up the pieces literally by separating with his own hands the good and evil which he'd caused to be mixed together. In other words, all the way through our lives, we confront mixtures of good and evil in our relationships with other people, in our own mental lives. There are mixtures which are incredibly confusing. And our attempt to separate the good from the negative, and sometimes it's not good from bad, sometimes it's lesser good from a greater good, and we have to be able to make choices. Should I do this or should I do that? But by following a path which attempts to make some kind of order in this confusion, as instructed by the Torah. And in fact, the complex teachings of the Torah are telling us which bits we can use in this way and which we have to separate altogether and move somewhere else. So that is the way in which we are doing what the Kabbalists call the work of sifting. It's as if we're sifting, and we are trying to find the sparks of holiness which are there at every level of existence and restore them in some way, so that the world becomes again a world of good. And so that is really our mission in the world. And what we are doing is putting right the confusion that was caused through the eating from the tree of knowledge on the part of Adam and Eve. So I thought that was rather a neat... he's probably contracted about 10 pages into that brief.
It was
put very succinctly. Yeah. The writer is a young man who used to live in England. His wife comes from England. And Chaim Miller. And he did that very, very nicely. Now, okay, so let's follow it through then in the text. I'm just trying to see what time it is.
10 past.
It's 10 past. Okay, so we'll take it. Now, Vatera Haisha, this is verse 6. The woman saw Kitov Ha'etz Lemacha, that the tree was good to eat. V'chita'avahu le'inayim, and it was desirous for the eyes. V'nechmad ha'etz lahaskil, and the tree was pleasant in order to gain understanding. V'tikach mipiryo, and she took from its fruit. V'tochal, and she ate. Vatiten gam liisha ima, and she also gave to her husband. Vayochel, and he ate. So there is this vayochel and he ate. So there is this desire. Now, desire for a forbidden thing is a very interesting concept. I mean, that's the whole problem with forbidden things. Yes, they're very tasty. If they would be boring.
That's what the thing is always more enticing.
Well, there is a phrase that Mayim Gnuvim Yumtaku, stolen water is sweet. In other words, even if it's something which in itself doesn't have anything tasty about it, if it's only stolen, if it's forbidden, then it's sweet. Now that's an interesting fact of life. That the, let's try to represent that graphically. You see, the world that we live in, this represents different dimensions of our world, has these sparks. And the sparks are the things which are really attracting us. It's an intriguing and slightly dangerous idea that what attracts us in the forbidden thing is a spark of holiness. There's a spark of holiness in the forbidden thing which is drawing us towards it.
And there are negative things usually.
Well, yes. Well, it's forbidden. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it might not look very negative, but it is negative, and that's why it's forbidden. However, we are being beckoned to encounter a challenge. And the question is, how can we elevate that spark? That spark is longing to reconnect with the divine. There is a sense in which there are sparks of holiness trapped in existence, in a kind of exile, in a kind of imprisonment. And in fact, when we look at the cultural artifacts, particularly of the 20th century, and the sense of angst, the fear, the deep dread, which is expressed in painting, in certain pieces of music, sometimes jazz will enter, there is a joyful dimension and there's also deep darkness. And it is the idea of a world which is in exile. And one is trying to redeem that exile. But the radiance is calling, and the question of whether it's appropriate to entangle with that radiance directly, that's what the Torah is trying to instruct us. And it will say, this kind of thing, keep away from. And it's by the fact of us having enough spiritual energy to keep away from that glowing spark that we enable the spark to rise and be connected to its source.
So we have to keep away from it.
If it's forbidden.
In spite of its attraction,
we have to be aware that there are very attractive things.
And it would be elevated because we.
Because we keep away, yes.
It would be, really?
Yes. Now the Zohar gives an intriguing image to illustrate this whole process. It says there was a king who wanted to test the morality of his son. So he summoned a beautiful harlot and he said to her, I want you to go to my son. He's going to be going out riding today. I want you to be somewhere around there and just make yourself available and tempt him. Now, the harlot knows that what the king wants is that the son should not be tempted. Her real desire is that the son should withstand her charms. And nonetheless, she has to dress in such a way that it's going to tempt this prince. Now, that's the ambiguity of the relationship that we have with the different challenges around us in the world. There is something tempting us, and yet the way in which we fulfill not only our ultimate purpose, but its ultimate purpose, the purpose of that sacred spark which wants to connect to us, that will really be achieved not by the prince giving in to the harlot, but by standing back and saying, look, no. And that is the way in which we move through the ups and downs of life and the different situations of life. Do we lose our temper? Do we not lose our temper? Yes, there are all kinds of more and less savory temptations that a person experiences. And the ability to hold back is something crucial. And then at other times, the Torah will say, this is right. This is appropriate. This is good. It's at this point where the very coming together of this person or these two people in this very appropriate way, yes, that's exactly what the spirituality of existence is about. So there are things that are forbidden and things that are permitted. And it is through us going through those different, maybe these look like waves. looks a bit like bots. Looks like a rather muddy and dangerous marshy area. So, or perhaps it's waves. So going through the waves of life with all the different aspects of energy and being able to hold back, that's the dealing with the ta'ava, dealing with the desire, the inappropriate desire, whatever it might be. However, they did eat, And now verse 7, Vatipakachna Eine Shnehem, and both of them, their eyes were opened, Adam and Eve, Vayedu Ke'erumim Heim, they knew they were naked. And as I mentioned the comment before, they were naked of a mitzvah. But the other way of understanding is suddenly they became conscious of physical nakedness as being something problematic. They suddenly saw, suddenly became very tangible to them, the Eish, the fire, the problematic fire, which is there in the physicality of the relationship of a male and a female. Up to then, they had been innocent and pure, and it was all holiness. And suddenly they see that there is a fire which can be a dangerous fire. And with that, they took leaves, vayit peru alei te'ena, they sowed leaves of a fig tree, vayasu lahem chagorot, and they made for themselves girdles, kind of loincloths. Vayishmu et kol Hashem Elokim mitalech bagan. Alright, I think that this is a further step, and we will try to tackle that next time. But that we have come to the point of the effect, the spiritual effect of what they have done. But let's.
Thank you, Tanya.